3,000 women with 6 FUDs. FUD is short for Elmer Fudd. It was Conan who had started that. "Hey, Fuddrucker," he called to Garcia, who halted and looked to be trying to decide whether to pretend he had not heard Conan or to deal with Conan as a problem. "But what is Fuddruckers?" Conan said to no one in particular, his usual audience. "The joke is that it almost makes you say fuck, right? But then what is a Rudfucker? They make this stuff up and we all pretend these places exist, like in history, like Fuddruckers is some kind of grand family tradition. My family has always gone there," Laura Lip said in a corrective tone as she sprayed with her Roundup bottle.
"We went to Hooters," Conan said.
"With your family?" Laura shook her head. "My girl and her kids," Conan said. "They have a good children's menu. But hey, you ever notice the O in Hooters is the same O like in IHOP? I was a cook at IHOP. To make the pancakes, you add water to a mix. It's the international house of just add water." I had been a waitress at IHOP right after I graduated high school. It was one of the many things Conan and I bonded over. I was waitress 43, and the cooks would call, "43, your order is up," which, as I only saw later, had been preparing me for here. To work at IHOP, you first go to Walmart or a place like it to get work shoes, where you see, if you didn't already know, that most of the adult-sized shoes they sell are for working on construction sites or in hospitals, prisons, restaurants, and schools, and the children's shoes are starter versions of the same. Waitress shoes and medical assistant shoes and work boots. Cheap factory knockoffs for people whose choices are to work these crap jobs or crack up and go to a much lower grade of low-grade shoe made by prison industries. This new cop pulled Sammy aside and started asking her questions. He was treading a familiar road. "I want to get to know you." That is how cops here do things. They all say the same thing in the same way. "I want to get to know you." There are cops and staff who want the girlfriend experience with a prisoner. Sammy already had a getting-to-know thing with the head of maintenance, a civilian who took her around in his truck, brought her staff cafeteria hamburgers, and in exchange, they went to a drainage ditch where he rummaged in her state-issue jeans. She had a male nurse at the skilled nursing facility, sniff is how we say it, who checked her breasts weekly and gave her tobacco. Conan had female guards who might have been lesbians or straight girls who found Conan convincingly male. "You remind me of someone," Garcia said to Sammy. "Back home in Philadelphia. Where are you from?"
"Philadelphia, huh?" Conan cut in. "You ever notice something about that Liberty Bell? It has a crack in it, and no one cares. They display it like they're proud, and the thing is cracked."
Garcia turned from Sammy to Conan. It was obvious what he wanted to say.
"Get away while I work on this chick."
"Are those regulation clothes you've got on, ma'am? Because I see boxer shorts, which are not allowed here. I could write you up for that."
I was exiting work exchange when I ran into the GED teacher, G. Hauser. I had gotten into a scuffle in work exchange where they said I was setting off the metal detector and went through all my stuff. They even tore apart the bologna sandwich and the sack lunch they give us outside chow hall to take to work. I had to strip out and endure a search in the little curtained area of work exchange, and I was boiling with anger as I left. But when I saw Hauser, something flipped in me. A switch. I called out a friendly hello. You don't decide to intentionally alter your tone of voice. It happens automatically. Needs are the gearbox of the voice. Needs shift approach, adjust tone to something higher, more sympathetic. It wasn't calculated, but everything had changed for me since I'd seen him last.
"Hey," I said, "I was wondering if I'd run into you."
I had forgotten all about him. I had not thought of him once.
"I'm on Sea Yard," I said, "and I've been thinking about your offer to get me some reading material. That would be great."
He was excited, like I was doing him a favor by asking for one myself.
We chatted, and in his growing excitement, he said, "Why don't you take my class?"
All they teach is GED prep here, which is the education level of our guards.
Yeah. He laughed quickly, covertly. But since it's the only thing offered, I structure it around reading. We read and talk about books. Try it out. I'd love to have you join us.
He told me how to sign up.
Sammy was right that having a job would keep me from falling apart. It did. It kept my mind off things. Instead, I concentrated, like everyone else, on what there was to be exploited. Conan was crafting dildos in woodshop. He began working on them as soon as our shop supervisor commenced his marathon reading sessions at his desk. Every day the supervisor brought a novel to work, settled in, and read compulsively. The book covers featured lurid images with raised letter titles, like Killed Twice. They were all water-damaged paperbacks you would find in a free box. The supervisor read at them for 7 hours straight, day after day, while Conan used sanders and chamfering tools to taper his creations. He and Teardrop had a rivalry going over who could craft the better dildo. They both also had contacts at Central Kitchen for illicit sale of cucumbers. The unit kitchens get their cucumbers pre-quartered to prevent non-intended and illegal use of provisions, i.e., as dildos. Prisoners who worked in Central Kitchen sold cucumbers uncut out the back door. The Norse made wooden swastikas and pentagrams. My own innovation was the lunch meat. At meal breaks, I began toasting my bologna slice with the branding iron we used for all our products. It said, CalPIA, California Prison Industry Authority, and I was in charge of it. I branded my lunch meat on both sides with the iron, and then my sandwich bread as well. The iron toasted the bread and the meat perfectly. I toasted other people's sandwiches in exchange for baggies of instant coffee. I learned to hide the coffee for strip out after work. This was how it was going to be, hustling for every little thing. On Saturdays, they let us go to the library. All they had for us to check out were Bibles. King James or International Version was the complete range of reading choices. Sammy and I went weekly to research who I could send letters to about Jackson. Exiting one afternoon, I ran into Hauser again. I would be starting his class soon. "There isn't anything to read here," I told him. "I know. That's why I ordered you some books. They haven't arrived yet? I had to get them from Amazon since we can't give you books directly." I pictured Sammy's hands reeling in the line, cultivating a victim. "Slowly," she'd said, "you've got to do it slowly." "I haven't got them yet," I told him, "but things took a while. They had to sort the mail for 3,000 women. I continued to call Johnson's lawyer because he was the only person I could contact since he had global tell link. He mostly avoided answering, but once he picked up. He had news, he said. He was retiring after 30 years as a public defender, and I would no longer be able to reach him at that office. The way things were closing in on me, it was hard to accept that this was real life. No one but me cared about the fate of Jackson. I didn't know where he was. I had no way to talk to him. I was trapped in a prison in the Central Valley under the baked expanse of sunny sky, gazing into the warble above the razor wire, counting how long it took the perimeter truck to circle our big enclosure, picturing tough and beautiful Angel Marie Janicki getting herself through the fence. I kept going over a scene from when Jackson was 5. It was autumn, and my mother came with us to Tilden Park in the East Bay. There were trees above us that had turned the color I might have dyed my hair, a bright, rich magenta. There were trees with gold and scarlet leaves. You don't see a lot of that in California. My mother and Jackson and I sat and watched the wind shake these bright painted trees. Jackson was enchanted. "All that beauty and for nothing," my mother said. "They'll fall off tomorrow." "But after they fall off," Jackson said, The tree will grow new leaves, Grandma, and then those will turn colors, like these ones.
It would keep happening over and over, Jackson said, through all the years. The leaves falling off meant new ones were coming.
My mother looked at him like she wondered what planet he was from.
He was born an optimist, and he didn't get it from her or from me. When Jackson was 3, he asked me how the Earth formed.
How did it get here?
I said no one knew for sure, but maybe there was an explosion and they called it the Big Bang.
But where did they put everyone while the explosion was happening?
In his mind, there were always people. People taking care of other people.
The lawyer had given me the phone number of child welfare, which he said might tell me the name of Jackson's case manager, but I could only contact people with a global Tellink account. I wrote letters and tried not to go insane. I sent one to Eva's old address and one to her at her father's address, but I had little faith that either would reach her. I called Jimmy Darling, but the call did not go through since he didn't have Global Tellink. I told myself if I ever got out, I'd blow up Global Tellink. I got a package. Like one of the lucky women who have family, outside help, I, Hall, got called to receiving and release to pick up my package. Hauser had gotten me 3 books. My Antonia, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and To Kill a Mockingbird.
That's what he got you? Sammy said, stifling a laugh. Even I read those already.
I felt sad and a little protective of the teacher for not knowing better. I planned on keeping them, even if I didn't especially want to read them. They were a link to the outside world. But a woman in my unit offered me shampoo and conditioner in exchange for all 3. The state gives us indigents only a gritty powdered soap for body and hair. Being able to properly wash and condition my hair made me feel happy, at least for an evening, in a way I had not experienced since before I was arrested 3 years earlier. I had been in Hauser's class for a couple of weeks when he stopped me after and asked if I'd enjoyed the books.
I enjoyed reading them, I said, when I was 14 years old.
I didn't plan on saying that. It certainly wasn't tactical for reeling in a Keith.
God, I'm sorry. That's embarrassing.
It's okay. You just don't know me.
He asked me what I wanted to read, and I said I didn't know. I said I had a lot on my mind, and it was hard to concentrate.
He got me more books. One, called Pickup, was about 2 drunks in San Francisco in the 1950s. I started reading it and could not stop. When I finished it, I read it again. Scenes came into view for me, even though the character in the book doesn't name many locations except Civic Center and Powell and Market, where the cable car turns around, which fascinated Jackson as it did all toddlers. I would take him down there to watch the street musicians. Some of them were friends of Jimmy Darling's. Jimmy knew all sorts of people in a way I didn't, and the night would go differently if by chance he and I ran into someone and they invited us to a concert or a party or a screening of a film. When I was a kid, there was a large Woolworths at Powell and Market with a wig department in the center of the store. Eva and I would go in and pretend we were wig shopping. The old ladies who worked there helped us pin our hair up in special nets and fitted us with grand and curly hairdos. We laughed and played around in the mirrors, sneaked makeup and hair products into our purses, and took pictures in the photo booth that was inside the store. Sometimes we went to Zim's on Van Ness afterward, ordered a lot of food, and left without paying. It was something different from dining and dashing at the more familiar Zim's on Taravelle. We felt sophisticated downtown. Sometimes we went into the museum up Van Ness to hide after booking from Zim's. There was a painting inside that Eva liked. It was called The Girl with Green Eyes. Among the kids we knew, you weren't supposed to be into going to museums, but Eva was into whatever she was into, this painted girl with a long neck that looked like it was squeezed into a napkin ring. She stared at us, and we stared back. The whole long era of my childhood, I had run around like a street urchin,
no more rooted than the teenagers on the posters in the Greyhound station on 6th Street. Tall figures in silhouette, like long shadows, and the words, "Runaways, call for help." A hotline number. My childhood was the era of the hotline, but we never called any, except as a prank, and I wasn't a runaway. I even had a mother. I might have gotten to know her, but I had not really. By the time I was 16, it was too late for me and my mother. When I went to prison, it seemed really and finally too late. But I was wrong. It was only too late when she died. I told Hauser I read Pickup. He asked what I thought. That it was good and bad at the same time. I know what you mean. The end is a surprise, right? But it makes you want to reread the book to see if there were earlier clues. I told him I'd done that, and that it was good to read a book about San Francisco, that I was from there. Oh, me too, he said. He didn't seem like it to me, and I said so. I mean near there. I'm from just across the bay, Contra Costa County. He named the town, but I hadn't heard of it. It's an armpit behind an oil refinery. It's not glamorous like being from the city. I said I hated San Francisco, that there was evil coming out of the ground there, but that I liked Pickup because it reminded me of things about the city that I missed. He had gotten me two other books, Charles Bukowski's Factotum and Jesus' Son by Dennis Johnson. I would read the others next, I told him. Factotum is one of the funniest books ever written. I said I knew of the other book, the Jesus one, because I saw the movie, which was good, except the people in it were supposed to be living in the 70s. The girl in it, she's got her midriff showing and wears a leather jacket with a fur collar like San Francisco hipsters in the 90s. But those people you're describing, maybe you, I don't know, they're all borrowing from the 70s to begin with. It was true. I told him how Jimmy Darling used to go to this bookstore in the Tenderloin to buy 1970s-era copies of Playboy, which they had in stacks on the floor in the back. An old man once tapped Jimmy on the shoulder and whispered, "Sonny, they have the new ones up here," nodding in the direction of the plastic-sleeved monthlies, Busty and Barely Legal, which were on display in the front of the store. And Jimmy is my fiancé. He teaches at the San Francisco Art Institute. Are you still engaged? He's dead, I said. That night, after lights out, I thought about North Beach and tried to revisit places I went with Jimmy Darling, who lived and worked over there, and before Jimmy, when I was a kid, and North Beach was an exciting place to wander on a Friday night with your friends. We would hover around the outdoor tables at Enrico's and finish people's drinks when they got up to leave. I saw the lights along Broadway, Big Al's, the Condor Club and its vertical sign, Carol Doda's nipples glowing cherry red, Chinatown red, the Garden of Eden down the street, its pink and green neon bright against the fog. Later they took the sign of Carol Doda down, but for me it remained. All those lights stayed on. In the world that had been, and that still existed in me, the one I contained. There was a club on Columbus where feminist strippers made 11 feminist dollars an hour. It was very little for what they gave out, and took in, watching men masturbate in the little booths around the stage. Regal Show World was a regular peep show without the feminism. The Regal's strange and uncomely accountant moonlighted with us at the Mars Room, and, as far as I knew, never found a single customer, but showed up, night after night, a big, awkward lady in thick glasses and discount lingerie, who den-mothered us in the dressing room with snacks and compliments on our makeup and costumes. She handed out baby carrots and called them crudité. She was especially fond of my friend Arrow, whom she regarded as her dressing room daughter. Arrow had made it into the pages of Barely Legal. She was my age, early 20s, but she had a lazy eye that gave her an innocent look, or at least the innocent look of women who pose as girls in Barely Legal. Arrow and I both took shifts sometimes at the Crazy Horse, where I first encountered Jackson's dad. He was good-looking and funny, the only doorman the girls at the Crazy Horse let in the dressing room. He pretended to read articles from the local newspaper out loud as the girls put on makeup, but inventing weekly world news-type headlines as he flipped pages. Woman lifts Volkswagen Beetle to save last cigarette from storm drain. Man who lost 200 pounds on chocolate chip cookie diet run over by milk truck. Breaking news, Toledo, Ohio is a figment of people's imagination. Jackson's dad did not lack intelligence. He just wasn't smart about life, which is to say, about authority. But he was smart enough to escape. He climbed a fence at a San Mateo County jail and ran all the way to San Francisco. I had heard that story before I knew him. I pictured a guy running along the side of the highway, as if to get from San Mateo to San Francisco, you'd have to go the way a car would travel, but without the shell of the car, the motor, just a man running and sweating in the breakdown lane. I'm sure that's not how he traveled, but it was what I saw. He was caught almost immediately. Jimmy the Beard had worked as a doorman at various strip clubs around town since the 1960s. He told stories. There was one about a crazy movie director who was in love with a porn star named Magic Tom. Magic Tom performed at a gay hardcore theater where Jimmy the Beard worked the door. Magic Tom wasn't interested in the movie director, used him and then left him for someone else. The spurned, angry movie director got on a Greyhound bus and went all the way to Syracuse, New York, where Magic Tom was originally from. The movie director knocked on the door of Magic Tom's mother's house. In the story Jimmy the Beard tells, the mother opens the door, a prim and buttoned-up old woman in upstate New York, says, "Yes, can I help you?" The filmmaker says, "No, ma'am, just thought you'd like to see something." He holds up a nude pictorial of Magic Tom and Magic Tom's identical twin brother in hardcore poses. They work together doing porn. Jimmy the Beard was laughing so hard by this point he could barely spit out the story. The guy shows this old lady in Syracuse, New York, a photograph of her two sons fucking each other. He thought that was the funniest story he'd ever heard. It starts to explain Jimmy the Beard's sense of humor, thinking it was funny to blow my cover with Kirk Kennedy. After I left San Francisco for Los Angeles, Kirk Kennedy persisted until he found out where I was. Jimmy the Beard told him. Chapter 15. By the time Gordon Hauser was into his second year at Stanville, he would not have mistaken the shriek of an animal for the shriek of a woman. The cry he had heard on that early night in his cabin had been a mountain lion, not a woman, and not in trouble. When snow blanketed the ground his first winter, paw prints went up around his property, scooped divots that matched exactly in pattern and spread those in his field guide, according to which the voice of the mountain lion had been variously described as sounding like the screaming, yelling, or moaning of a female human. He never saw a mountain lion, only heard them. In the early morning, on his way down the mountain toward Stanville, he sometimes glimpsed gray foxes, their lustrous tails trailing after them as he followed the curves of the winding road, passing huge, drought-desiccated live oak, their jagged little leaves coated in dust, and banks of rust-red buckeye and smoke-green manzanita. The buckeye branches without leaves glinted bone-white in the sun. The grasses were the rich yellow of wet straw. He'd never seen such beautiful grasses. On the straightaway toward the Brown Basin, the scenery changed to oil pipeline and derricks, whose axles wound and wound. After the derricks was a dusty orange grove, one farmhouse with two palm trees in front, where the road split. The two palms were a curious variety, thickly shaggy and luxurious like an Inuit's snow boots. On the valley floor, the temperature was 20 degrees hotter and the air heavy with the smell of fertilizer. There were no more oranges, no oil derricks, just power lines and almond groves in huge geometric parcels all the way to the prison. Like all California prisons, Stanville flew three flags, state, nation, and POW/MIA. The POW flag had always seemed pathetic to Gordon, since it was for those left behind in Vietnam, a war the U.S. had lost, and badly. Any prisoners not returned were probably long dead, and either way, no one was going back for them. But prison guards at every state facility muscled up a flag in their honor. When people were captured now, it was different. A lot of them were private contractors, and they got beheaded live on the internet. President Bush went on TV and said he was building hospitals and schools for the Iraqi people. Most of the cars in staff parking at Stanville had the yellow ribbon on the bumper. The prison was complicated to navigate. It all looked the same to Gordon, one- and two-story detached cinder-block buildings in a vast expanse of dirt and concrete surrounded by shrouds of razor wire. He went through three electronic sally ports to get to his classroom, which was in a windowless trailer near the vocational workshops and central kitchen. From the kitchen pumped a constant smell of rancid grease, overpowered only by the drift of solvents from the auto body shop, where a row of trucks, guards' private vehicles, were lined up for super discounted paint jobs by inmates. Gordon had clearance to enter this part of the grounds, but the housing units and yards were off-limits to him, with the exception of one cell block on A Yard, 504, where he could work with people from death row and administrative segregation. Gordon had dreaded death row, but found that it didn't quite conform to his nightmares about it. He'd imagined iron bars, a medieval vision of misery. It was automated and modern, each tiny cell with a white-painted steel door and small glass window. There were 12 women, one to a cell, and a cramped alley with tables and sewing machines surrounded by meshed cage. A guard unlocked an entrance in the cage and led Gordon in to meet with students one-on-one, while others knitted or made hook rugs at nearby tables. Betty LaFrance, who was not Gordon's student but always insisted on speaking to him, brought a radio from her cell and played elevator music as she crafted. The women made greeting cards by hand in emulation of a machine-printed corporate look. Their best work resembled cards you could buy at Rite Aid, with blandly inspirational messages in a neutral script. The women were allowed to come and go from their cells, which smelled of Renuzit air freshener, and were blanketed in homemade afghans for privacy and probably to have some use for these afghans they churned on the oily axle of time. They called him Deary and Pumpkin and Doll. Deary creeped him out. It was what the old pawnbroker, Elzbieta, calls Raskolnikov before he carries out his plan to murder her. Or at least that was the English equivalent the translator had chosen, Deary. Administrative segregation on the floor above death row had no common area and there was no interaction among women except yelling. The women hollered from one cell to another, heckled guards, made noise to have something to do. Gordon waited in a small office as a student clink-jangled down the hall in her restraints and was put in a cage for the lesson with him. That was where he first met Romy Hall, who was in his class now. What he had noticed about her was that she looked him in the eye. Many of the women had this way of looking at his shoulder or past him. Their eyes rolled every which direction to avoid his. Also, she was attractive, despite the conditions. Wide-set, greenish eyes. A mouth with a cupid's bow, was that what it was called? An upper lip that swooped a swooped. A pretty mouth that said, "Trust this face." And the face said, "This is not what it seems." She spelled well, read with good comprehension. He wasn't looking for a good speller. He wasn't looking for anything among the women in Stanville. He'd seen her again in what the guards called a dog run, the outdoor cages where women in ADSEG were placed for exercise. The walkway to 504 routed past a series of them, and his instinct was to avoid staring at the women trapped in these barren little enclosures. Hall had called to him in a casual way, like a woman asking a man for a light, or if he knows what time the train stops here. He liked having her in class. She did the reading in earnest. A lot of his students thought Gordon was stupid, spoke in codes and laughed at him, but this seemed fair enough. They had state commitments he could hardly understand. LWAP, which was life without parole, or multiple life sentences. Even a single life sentence was difficult for him to get his head around. He passed out photocopied sections of books, Julie of the Wolves, Laura Ingalls Wilder, but he didn't tell the prisoners they were children's books, and it didn't matter if the women enjoyed them. He kept it simple, since many had only an elementary school education. They wrote in bubble letters like adolescent girls. Even London, who the others called Conan and looked like a man, wrote in bubble letters. London was clever, it was obvious. Never did the reading, but made the others laugh, which was something.
Is bosom plural? London asked.
Depends on whose, maybe, someone said.
The Bosom of Jones sounds like an adventure film. Lieutenant Jones and the Bosom of Doom.
Geronima Campos, an old Native American woman, painted in her sketchbook all through class time. Gordon wondered if maybe she could not read or write. One day after class, he asked her what she painted. If she admits she cannot write, he decided, he could suggest she work with him independently.
Portraits, she told him.
She opened her sketchbook to show him. Each page had an image and under it a name. She could write. But the images were not faces. They were wild streaks of color. This is you, she said, and showed him a scribble of black lines with a staining splotch of blue. When his class discussed a chapter of The Red Pony by John Steinbeck, the women talked about the mountains in the book and the ones they could see from Main Yard. They seemed afraid of the mountains, which surprised Gordon. He figured they'd regard the mountains as freedom, the one thing they could glimpse of the natural world.
You gotta fight bears up there, Conan said. At least in here it's just cubs. Cubs and scrubs, and I know I can win.
When they got to the third chapter, The Promise, about Nellie, the pregnant mare, one woman raised her hand and said when she'd delivered, her belly was heart-shaped. In two parts, she said, just like a horse, and even the doctor confirmed it, that horses have a heart-shaped womb. They read from the chapter out loud. At the mention of pigs, a student interjected that her cousin wrote her from lockup in Arizona that they had a gas chamber where they put a pig one Sunday a month to test the machine. Gordon tried to steer the discussion back to the book. What was the promise that Billy Buck made? The girl whose cousin had written her about the pigs gassed on Sundays said that when the pig went up the pipe, a smell settled down over the yard. Smelt like peach blossoms, she said. That's what my cousin told me. Romy Hall raised her hand. She said Billy Buck promised the boy, Jody, a healthy foal. Earlier, Billy Buck had promised to look after the red pony, and the pony had died. This new vow was Billy Buck's chance to be a man of his word by delivering the foal safely.
Did he keep it? Gordon asked.
She said that was the trick of the story. Technically, yes, but in order to deliver the foal, he had to kill the mare. He killed the mare to save its breech foal. He smashed its skull with a hammer, and that was a bullshit way to keep a promise. The mare could have had other foals that weren't breech, but she had to die because some cowboy was hung up on himself as a man of his word.
It's okay to make a promise, London said to Gordon, as if summarizing for the teacher how life actually worked. But it's not always a good idea to keep one.
One evening, as class ended, Romy Hall hovered. Gordon started collecting papers from an awkward position on the far side of his own desk in order to create more distance between them. She told him many things about herself in the span of about 5 minutes. She spoke them in a controlled voice. It seemed to Gordon she had been saving it up. He kept stepping back to be farther from her, and she kept stepping toward him, and he was not going to be manipulated. One woman had tried to bribe him into smuggling cell phones for her, another tobacco. Staff and guards alike were involved in these schemes. Gordon wanted no part. She was a lifer, she told him, and the mother of a young boy. She apologized for troubling him, said she woke up depressed, could feel the fog in her cell, even without a window, and said the dampness of it reminded her of home. She wanted him to call a telephone number to find out where her kid was. She had it all written down, and this was exactly the kind of thing he'd been backing away from as she moved toward him. Just because he had bought her books or found her pretty, just because he thought about her sometimes, that didn't mean he was looking for family dramas. The assistance he gave on his own and against the rules had all started with Candy Pena on death row. Candy had cried like a child because she had no more wool and no money, and so she couldn't help the babies. The others on death row were knitting baby blankets that would go to a Christian charity in Stanville. He knew he could bring in wool. They almost never looked in his bag. He was eating breakfast at Baresi's when he made the decision. The place soothed him with its framed pictures of stock cars, victories from the local track. One side was a diner and the other a bar with a piano in the corner. On Saturday nights, a woman played it. You could not get dental work done in Stanville. There was no shoe repair. You could not buy a decent cook pot, not even one up to Gordon's low standards. But there were 3 hobby and crafting stores. He went to one, bought 4 colors of yarn. Candy had said wool, although the craft store sold no yarn that was made of wool, not even partially, but maybe wool no longer meant wool, but instead fluffy knittables. The next day he gave what he'd bought to Candy. She melted in gratitude, which made him feel obscene. Not because it was against the rules, but because it had been almost no trouble, and yet she cried and said no one had ever done anything so nice for her, not once in her life. The only remedy seemed to be to do favors for others so that he wasn't Candy's saint, to neutralize the act of giving by giving more. Betty LaFrance asked Gordon if he would mail a letter for her to an old lover, she explained, who was in a California state prison himself. Prisoners were not allowed to contact other prisoners without express approval from the Department of Corrections. This Gordon knew to be true. But he figured Betty probably imagined this romance she told him about. She'd been yelling to get the guard's attention the first time Gordon met her. "Officer," she'd called, "please tell the parking lot attendant to reserve a spot for my hairdresser." She snubbed the other women on death row, told Gordon they were not of her caliber. Once, she asked Gordon if he'd ever flown business class on Singapore Airlines. When he said no, she seemed to pity him. She was a deluded woman sentenced to die. He felt for her. He sent the letter. He bought seeds for a student in his class who gardened. She had brought Gordon fresh mint as a present, and when Gordon asked her where she got it, she said it rode into the prison on old lumber, 4x12s they were using for construction. She'd replanted it, watered it. She told him she watched the sky and waited for birds to excrete seeds and germinated them secretly in wet paper towels. Rules were such that no plants were supposed to grow, but the captain on D Yard, where she lived, let her have her plants. She was a lifer. Gordon gave her a seed packet of California poppies. She put her hands to her face to hide her tears. "This is a godshot," she said. "Thank you for this godshot." Which started the cycle over again, the discomfort, their outsized gratitude. The packet of seeds had cost him 89 cents. And so he had been sending books to Romy Hall. You go on Amazon, click a button. What was 20 bucks to him if spending it meant several weeks of freedom of thought for someone in prison? But looking into her personal life in the outside world, calling a number on her behalf, that was different. It was honest-to-God meddling, not just in her life, but in his own, too. He put the paper she had given him on his coffee table, a phone number and the name of her child. He did not call, and to his relief, or his mixed relief, she did not ask him about it. They chatted, but about insignificant things. She thinks I won't help her, that I don't care. But he wanted her to know that he did care, and that it was not nothing to him that she had asked him that favor. He sat on his couch, picked up the scrap with the number, and put it back down. Instead of calling it, he went online and figured out how to order a new paint set for Geronima from a catalog supplier. Something easy that required no deep deliberating. Geronima brought the new paint set to class and worked diligently for several weeks before approaching Gordon. "I'd like to show you what I've been working on. Portraits, but the kind you probably prefer."
"That I prefer?"
"Well, most people prefer." She showed him. They were skillful illustrations, immediately recognizable. Herself, London, Gordon, Romy, everyone in class. They had the economy of caricatures. She turned the page to an unfamiliar face staring from the paper, the cheeks streaked in tears. "That's Lily, who lives on my unit and reminds me of my younger sister. I don't have a picture of my sister, so I asked her to pose." Chapter 16.
In spring, I began hearing disagreeable noises in machinery, sometimes surprisingly loud, depending upon meteorological conditions. Thawing winter meant otherwise pleasant excursions were ruined for me by the moaning and howling of these iron monsters, audible for miles over the hills. Made up my mind to get revenge. But it was difficult to determine just where the noise was coming from. Had to wait for summer anyway because my traps could have easily been fouled with snow. But later in spring, the noise stopped. I began hearing it again in summer. I followed the noise to learn it came from a logging operation at Willow Creek Drainage, logging off one of my favorite wild spots, pushing trees over with bulldozers instead of cutting with saws. I watched from a high rock where I wasn't visible. After they'd finished for the day, the whole surface of the ground was stripped right off. I came down to the worksite after they'd gone. A 5-gallon can of oil was sitting on the machine they'd used to pick up logs and load them on trucks. I poured oil over the machine's engine and set fire to it. I spent a pleasant night sleeping on top of the mountain and came home leisurely in the morning. I felt so good having done this, though a mite uneasy over the risk of being suspected.
Chapter 17. Doc had been to Las Brisas the night he got the call about the burglary of a pawn shop on Beverly in Filipino Town. The pawn shop's silent alarm was going off. Doc decided to pull up with no lights or sirens in case the scene was still active. The suspect he sees is still there. The guy's car, a beat-up Chevy Caprice, will not start. He keeps turning the key. The starter whines, but won't catch. Doc sneaks up on him, aims his service revolver at the guy's head, and asks him politely to get out of the car. His voice, Doc's, becomes gentle, like the voice of Mr. Rogers, but not an imitation of someone on TV. It is a voice that fits Doc like a glove. Doc is clean-cut, looks more like a dentist than a cop. He thought of his image in terms of basketball. This was the early 1990s, and if there were guys on the force using street style and street language, like the Lakers in their knee-length shorts, Doc, as he thought of it, played for the Utah Jazz, a team whose point scorers were white men in fitted shorts. Men who, like Doc, also resembled dentists and spoke intelligently about strategy and technique, unlike the retards who got on camera for post-game rap and said they won by taking their time and picking their shots. Taking my time, picking my shots. That's all most of the players ever said, like it was something they memorized. But really, it was a good formula. It was how Doc did things, too. Doc says, "Sounds like you've got car trouble." Then he calmly asks the suspect how the burglary went. "The what?" The guy is confused. "Black dude.
In Doc's line of work, black people give him the most trouble, or rather, he gives them the most trouble. Doc puts the guy spread eagle against his clunker and takes his stolen loot off the front seat, which is in a pillowcase, like Doc remembered using to trick-or-treat when he was a boy to get the most candy, fuck everybody else. The pillowcase is full of weapons, watches, jewelry, the usual. The guy has a gun on him, so Doc takes that as well. It's a Glock. Doc is pleasantly surprised this guy in a trashed car that won't start has a decent weapon that Doc might keep instead of sell. Doc's police radio statics out a message. Backup is on its way to Beverly and Vendome. Backup? He has not called for backup, but according to dispatch, it is on its way. Maybe it's a ghost patrol. That's a scam people were running. The commissioner wants so many cars out in the division. Well, screw the commissioner. Officers all over town were fooling dispatch into thinking they were out on calls while they sat around eating and gambling or going to the gym or banging box in an hourly joint down on Western, the Snooty Fox, a popular spot for guys on the force. It was clean, Doc wants you to know, not your typical Venus flytrap for rock smoking and $5 head. The Snooty Fox was classy, with sweets and a good ice machine, and they had mirrors on the ceiling so you could watch yourself. Doc considers it an oddity that a mirror would be for looking at anything but yourself. He would have these conversations with the guys down at Rampart, and Doc always said the same thing. If I want to see what some whore looks like from behind, I turn her over. I don't need a mirror for that. What I can't see without the mirror is me. Doc decides whatever squad car the backup is, they are probably down at the Snooty Fox, getting their dicks wet. The suspect faces him, hands up. Take it easy, Doc says. Look, neither one of us can squirm out of this, so let's work with each other. I can make this easier. You're going down to central booking. Tomorrow you'll have an arraignment, and the court will appoint you a decent lawyer. Or they wouldn't, Doc knew. At most, you'll serve a 2-year sentence. The suspect starts to sniffle. Hey, I understand. You were just trying to pull a quick job. The suspect stares at Doc, not unsuspiciously, because he's scared, and he probably hates cops. This is messed up, he says. Doc hears sirens wailing toward the Virgil, Temple, Silver Lake, Beverly Junction. Backup really is on its way. If the light is red, he has time while the squad car slows in order to navigate through that multi-lane intersection against oncoming traffic. Doc takes out a cigarette. This kind of thing isn't fun for me either. He offers one to the suspect, who eyes him warily and shakes his head, blinking back tears. You can put your hands down, Doc says, exhaling smoke. I have your weapon. I know you're not a threat. Just don't do anything stupid. But relax. You're making me nervous. The suspect looks at him. He keeps his hands raised. Relax, seriously. I'm going to let these other guys book you, the car that's on its way. You know why? I hate sending people to jail. Now come on, I'm ordering you to put them down. I can tell you're a good kid. I bet this was your first burglary, which is why you fucked it up so badly. Put your hands down and take a breather. In a moment, these guys will cuff you, and the cuffs won't feel good. The suspect's eyes shine with fear. He begins to bring his arms down a little. He wipes his wet face with the arm of his shirt. Remember the era when everyone wore those rugby shirts with thick, vertical, brashly colored stripes and an offset collar? That's what the suspect had on. Doc hated those shirts. The suspect puts his hands all the way down. That a boy, Doc says. Try not to worry. I know the officer on intake. I'll ask him to go easy on you. You might even bond out tonight. The suspect brings his arms not just down, but toward his pockets. At the moment when the suspect's hands go into the pockets, Doc fires at his face, twice, aiming upward. Backup arrives a few seconds later, enough long seconds to stash the pillowcase Doc has inherited. Two officers from Central Division pull up. Jesus, what happened here? The suspect is slumped against the grill of his car. Behind him, a radius of blood speckles the car's hood.
I tell him hands up, Doc says, and he goes straight for his pockets. I wasn't taking any chances.
He didn't know why he'd done it. The child rapist could burn in hell, but why did he kill that kid on Beverly?
If the kid had said to Doc, "Why are you doing this?" Doc might have stopped himself because he did not know. The kid could not ask that because Doc hadn't given him time to.
He and his old partner, Jose, it's true they tortured a victim, a manager at a gentleman's club under the 605 freeway, and when they were done, they dumped the body near the 710 freeway. But the guy had raped Jose's girlfriend, so what were they supposed to do? The press made a big deal of the torture, but Doc is no sicko nor serial killer. He did it to make it look as if someone of that type did the killing.
It wasn't all like that. Doc was a popular detective, someone you might have envied if you spotted him out riding with a handful of other off-duty officers along the cliffs above Malibu on a mild, windless day. There was a group of them that went up the Pacific Coast Highway. Doc was usually on his 78 Sportster, not some full-dress late-model fag-mobile as you often see parked outside Neptune's Net on the PCH, the rider handling it like with butler's gloves because the thing is leased. Doc hates faggots who lease Harleys, and for the record, owned, too. Paid cash for both, the Sportster and a Softail. The Softail, equally stripped down, but with cowhide saddlebags for trips up to his place in Three Rivers, where he owned outright a plot of land with a stream running through it, another enviable feature of Doc's old life. Beautiful high country, fantastic trout fishing, clean air. A rustic log cabin where he injected meth and fucked women he brought up from South L.A.
Three Rivers takes him to something intriguing. He sees hips and thighs splayed out. It's what happens to a woman's body when the clothing comes off, hips spreading against the spongy pushback of the lumpy mattress in his country place. He sees the cheap wood paneling, a hairy snatch, wet, relaxed looking. He parts the lips with his fingers, uses the other hand to ready himself. This is working. He can't see a face, but he doesn't need or want one. He sees the spread thighs and hears the squeak of that old bed frame as he shifts into position. Feels the heat of a still room on a summer day, and this is working. All the sex he ever had, all that remained were these moments you looped. Hips pushing, wood paneling, bed squeak, hands on his backside. He's a man, okay? It's backside, not ass. He grabs hers, grabs a handful of it. The way her hips spread out beneath him on that country mattress, that was what helped him get this going. He goes deep. The bed is squeaking like crazy. He's at the finish and that noisy bed frame sounds like it's being split apart with an axe. But this one, which he sinks into, catching his breath? No. This bed is concrete. He lies back in the still heat of the cell, tries to sustain this feeling of the still heat of a summer day up in Sequoia country. Warm enough, his Harley requires no choke, just starter to idle in a liquid transition. On an afternoon like that, he'd go to the biker bar in Three Rivers, leave the woman, whichever one, at the cabin, with confiscated drugs and satellite TV. He sits at the bar and drinks cold draft beer. People snub Budweiser for these dumb brands no one's heard of, but Budweiser is the king of beers for a reason. It's good. His roommate is in the common area, plucking the strings of his big yellow guitar. Sounds like Led Zeppelin, but what white guy bluesy fingerwork on an acoustic guitar doesn't? The cellmate is a decent musician for a creep who fucked his own daughter. Everyone else is on the yard. Doc does not go on the yard. If you need it spelled out for you, the prison yard is no place for a cop, even the sensitive needs yard, unless it's Powderpuff softball day, which Doc will risk himself in order to watch. Doc is feeding his pet lizard when his cellmate returns. He recently discovered that static cling sheets, orderable from Wackenhorst Catalog Supply, will function as mesh to cover the top of the lizard's cardboard terrarium. The terrarium is made from a Nike shoebox. Doc only wears white sneakers, hospital clean, works on them several times a day with cell block 64, and goes through many pairs thanks to what various people on the force pay him to keep quiet. He's feeding the lizard little pieces of leaf from the cutting he is growing in a jar. He enjoys a bit of plant and animal life in the cell, as long as it is tidy and clean and doesn't introduce any weird stenches. He watches the lizard watch his big hand hold out the leaf, and then it... Something has reduced him to a question mark. He's down, but coming to. The cellmate? Wow. Has whacked him in the back of the head. With Doc doesn't know what. Something major. He can't get air. Doc is being choked now by a homemade garrote. Is there any other kind of garrote? The mind wanders, even at critical moments. They always say, homemade garrote. Doc reaches for it. It's strong. It's made of... He cannot breathe. Dental floss? Guitar string? He is sputtering and grunting with an animal's desire for life. Doc tries to. He can't. Chapter 18. I felt free of Kurt Kennedy in Los Angeles, though several times I had to double-take men who shared his generally repulsive physical qualities. Thick, bunched calves, ruddy skin, bald and dented cranium, and once I mistakenly thought I heard the gravelly voice. But Los Angeles was a new planet with creamsicle sunsets, sandals in January, giant birds of paradise, supermarkets with gleaming rows of tropical produce. I began to relax, to feel free of the suffocating familiarity of San Francisco. In truth, I moved me and Jackson to Los Angeles not only to get away from Kurt Kennedy, but so that I could be with Jimmy Darling after he got the teaching job in Valencia. The property he sublet belonged to an eccentric old painter who was away in Japan. Most of the structures on the ranch had burned in a forest fire, so the old painter lived in an Airstream trailer. He'd built a wood trellis over it that had vines on it to keep the place cool. Jackson loved it there because it was almost like camping. Off a ways from the trailer was a milk-green Andy Gump porta-potty, its door permanently wired open. I went up there to lie in a hammock in the shade with Jimmy, eat purple prickly pear that grew along the property borders, and let Jackson feed apples and weeds to the retired Arabian mares that grazed in a big soggy pasture. We would spend the night but always left first thing in the morning and made the long drive back to my own borrowed place, my so-called reality. I didn't want to live with Jimmy. He was not the sort of person you move in with, make a life with. He did his thing, and I did mine, and every few days we got together and entertained each other but kept it light. We walked around the property. He and Jackson whittled together. Scratched the neck of a pot-bellied goat that was the old painter's companion. When it rained up there, the abandoned swimming pool of the burned-down property next door was overtaken by frogs, whose chorus of croaks delighted Jackson. After I put Jackson to sleep on a mat on the trailer floor, Jimmy Darling and I would drink tequila at a picnic table under a tarp, and then have gratifying and drunken sex in the one bed in the trailer. Both bed and trailer too small for two, by intent and design. The painter who lived on the horse ranch was escaping the clutches of various women, Jimmy said. The porta-potty was a message that women should not get too comfortable. The bed was a twin. Jackson and I only went there on weekends. Jackson was in kindergarten, so it wasn't practical to go during the week. The arrangement was fine with me, but sometimes... As I drove toward downtown L.A. with Jackson in the back seat, I felt I was going down into a solitude that was too airy and roomy. Jimmy, on the other hand, probably just went out into the old painter's studio and started building and making because he was a builder and maker and had little tendency toward destructive introspection. I would drive past the ugly power plant in Burbank and see the steam billowing from its reactor mouths and be faced with what I did not like to admit, which was that Jimmy Darling was free of worry.